This is Orson Welles speaking. 2 weeks ago, I asked you all to go on strike. As price control came to an end, I proposed that all of us stop paying prices for anything until prices were controlled again. My plan for our dealing with the profiteers by not buying anything except the very barest essentials has been given a rather important-sounding title. A National Consumers Buying Strike is what they're calling it, and I hear from Washington that the idea has made a few lobbyists shudder. Well, I'm glad. If they shuddered, it was not because they're afraid of me, but because they're worried about you. But the news is bad. The president's veto message was saluted with a great salvo of popular applause, but in spite of this, the administration has started to weaken and compromise. Yes, the administration, I'm very sorry to tell you, has decided to make the best of a bad bargain, to wring a few minor concessions out of Congress and let it go at that. Slice that any way you want to. That still is not price control, it's controlled inflation. What does that mean? It means such a panic of strikes as will make anything that's gone before look like a picnic. You can expect labor to take a lot, but you can't expect labor to take less than it needs to live. This is an election year. Sure, sure, sure. We know all about that. They tell me in Washington that the administration's leaders are too tired to fight. But a lot of people are tired of fighting. 250,000 American boys are too tired to fight because they're dead. But they didn't die to make the world safe for inflation. That wasn't the general understanding. I won't try to tell you what they died for, but we might mention today that the dead have a few rights in a free country. Now I'm going to raise a lone voice in dissent. I hate to do it, but I do enjoy calling a spade when needs must be. The papers now are full of a new congressional investigation. This time the accused war profiteers, the Garson brothers, are getting just what they've got coming to them. Their names are being treated in the press as were names like Dutch Schultz and Al Capone. But one Washington paper, a wee bit hostile to anything except white Gentiles of its publisher's denomination, persists in quoting from Who's Who in American Jewry about the Garson brothers to make it all look like a big Jewish plot. The same paper does not quote from Who's Who among the Baptists to spend its venom on Mr. Andrew May, the congressman who's been mentioned in the investigation. But why all the surprise? That's what I want to know. Why all the commotion? Doesn't everybody realize that a good hunk of our Congress isn't above taking a little here and there in one form or another? Well, I know senators who play the cotton market speculation on inside information. Drew Pearson has named them. I know liberal congressmen, and I use the word liberal in all sincerity, who are well-financed by small businessmen in their districts and who live off federal contracts. That's how these congressmen get back into office every year. Is anybody surprised at that? It's common knowledge that it's common practice. What I want to know is, when are we going to do something about it? When are we going to stop treating Congress like a lunatic asylum? When are we going to make Congress clean up its own mess and wash behind its collective ears and, yes, even bathe in public? The bath is drawn. They call it the La Follette Mulroney bill. It's a good bill. It provides for a raise in congressmen's salaries so they won't have to beg or steal enough to live in the accustomed fashion and still make ends meet. This bill, besides, would civilize the whole business of congressional hearings so that both houses don't have to waste time by holding separate hearings with the same witnesses on the same subject. Calls for adequate research facilities, a most important item, and for sufficient clerical help to handle a congressman's mail and sufficient technicians to give the lawmakers adequate information on pending legislation. This house cleaning Congress desperately needs. The people of this nation desperately need this if they're to maintain their confidence in representative government. So let Congress pass the La Follette-Monroney bill and clean itself up before its vacation this summer. So the weary battle goes on in Washington. And then there's the Battle of Paris. Paris in the summer is even less pretty than Paris in the spring. I mean, of course, the Paris of the foreign ministers' meeting. Watching them as we have all this time, with all the patience and generosity that common sense will permit, it really does begin to look as though petty greed and blind local interest have led the spokesmen of the nations into such a series of stalemates and rat runs that they no longer know what they're doing and what they hope will be done. Quibble, 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 while the atom bomb ticks and ticks and ticks. There's Mr. Molotov. What's the matter with him? He frets about an I that isn't dotted and a T that isn't crossed. And the bomb ticks on. Then after the dot is firmly on the I and the T is crossed according to specifications, Mr. Molotov objects to the kind of paper the whole foolish limerick is written on, and then there's that wily bully of Great Britain, Mr. Bevan, barking about Palestine, making his little squeeze plays on the little islands of Italy. What's the matter with him? Isn't too hard to guess. And look at Mr. Burns, grabbing his handkerchief every time Arthur Vandenberg sneezes. Gentlemen, gentlemen. Somebody pound the table, please, with a gavel. Ask the spokesman to stop speaking for just a minute. And listen. Tick, tick, tick. Gentlemen, what possible difference does it make if the line you draw is 5 miles north or south? 5 miles is 4 seconds flight to an atomic warhead mounted before a Super V-83 jet-propelled projectile. Gentlemen, 4 seconds isn't worth the argument. You'll be 4 days older before you win or lose. Well, the bomb blew up over Bikini. Radio listeners reared on Martian broadcasts were unimpressed. So were various admirals from the American Navy, a lonely observer from the Soviet Union, and a number of goats. The smoke, it seems, was insufficiently smoky. The noise wasn't so noisy, and the flash wasn't so flashy, after all. Can't have been a very big bomb. It was certainly a big target. The little bomb missed the big target by just a bit less than a mile. The little bomb knocked out 9 clay pigeon battleships and sunk 5. Quite a little bomb. The Russians, who don't have the little bomb, want peace as much as we do, but the Russians don't think we are capable of keeping it. Keeping the peace, I mean, not the bomb. The main reality of the moment is that we aren't giving the bomb away. The Russians now suggest that we give it up. And if there's any moral sense in our position, it's the broad hint in the Baruch report that we all ought to give up fighting wars, whether with bombs, bubonic sprays, cholera fogs, or crossbows. It's a cinch we aren't going to settle anything with a crossbow anymore, and if we try anything serious with any of our new toys, the decision's going to the conqueror worm. The Russians aren't going to sit still for control of the atom by any machinery that isn't geared to the Security Council, where the veto is the Kremlin's assurance of the last word in any argument. Without that veto, the Russians won't go along with any program for making the atom behave, but the veto vetoes such a program. The Russians, who don't have the bomb, want to pass a law against anybody else using it. But we've tried limiting armaments, and that doesn't work. We've tried outlawing weapons. That doesn't mean anything. We'd better hurry up and start outlawing war. You can't punish a nation for the crime of war until you've got something bigger than any nation to wear the policeman's star, to sit at the bench and dispense, among all nations, an old-fashioned commodity known as justice. Last week in Mississippi, Negroes voted for the first time. But the man who was nominated, which means sure election in Mississippi, campaigned on the cry that Negroes have no such right, no matter what the Supreme Court may say to the contrary. Indeed, the man Bilbo stands squarely on the platform that Negroes have no rights at all, no matter what the Declaration of Independence may say to the contrary, or the Bible, or any of the documents of democracy, no matter what the Negroes may say to the contrary. Theodore Gilmore Bilbo has been a United States Senator twice before. He's been twice governor of Mississippi, which time he built himself $75,000 worth of mansion back in 1908. A single vote in the Mississippi State Senate saved him from being fired for taking bribes. Theodore Gilmore Bilbo wears a scarlet tie to match his nose, but this is nothing to the point. Neither are the senator's campaign speeches. I cannot quote from them because most of the content is what a radio network calls obscene. Theodore Gilmore Bilbo used to be a minister of the Lord. The state of Mississippi and the white race ought to be ashamed of him. I'm sure the Lord is. Well, here's a letter from a southern lady. Very nice letter. Dear Mr. Wells, I wonder if you have any idea, Mr. Wells, what it's like to be brought up in the South. To have it drilled and pounded into your mind from the time you're born that you're better and superior to the colored man. No, of course you don't. But I do, for I was born in the South. Oh, yes, I had my colored mammy, and I adored her. I played with the colored children in the backyard. But all the time I had the belief that God had created them to serve me and my kind. How could I believe otherwise? How could I know differently when that's what I'd been taught? Oh, I was never unkind to them, but they just couldn't come in our front door or sit down with us, or in other words, meet us on our social scale. Well, Mr. Wells, I've changed a lot since those days, not overnight, but when I first went to New York 6 years ago to live, I was a rebel in every sense of the word. The first time a colored man came and sat down by me on a subway, I got up and moved to another seat. If one sat down by me and there was no other seat, I stood up. It wasn't very long till I realized that I wasn't hurting anyone but myself. No one cared whether I stood up or sat down. After I'd been there for a while, I said to myself, no one asks you to come up here. If you don't like it, go back. Either accept these people and their customs or go on back down south where you belong. Well, I decided to accept them, but that's all I did, just accept them. Then one Sunday afternoon, my son, who was in the Merchant Marine, and I were walking in Central Park. My son has been all over the world. Thank God he has no prejudice in his heart. I'm very proud of him. Well, suddenly we came face to face with a colored man. Evidently my son knew him, for he spoke and extended his hand. I was horrified. Oh, naturally, I didn't show it, but that old prejudice sprang up in my heart like an evil, slimy reptile. After we left him and continued on our walk, I asked my son, did you have to shake hands with him? My son just turned and looked at me. Then he very quietly replied, Mother, that man was on the same ship with me. He saved my life. He's my friend. There was something in the way he said friend that made me look at him. Then he told me a story about his last trip at sea. They'd hit a terrific storm. The wind had blown them 250 miles off their course. Finally, the engines, the great ship was being slowly pounded to pieces on the rocks. During the events, my son slipped on the icy deck and fell. The ship carried a large number of telegraph poles. After the other cargo had been washed overboard, nothing was left to hold them in place, and they started rolling. One of these poles caught my son across the leg, pinning him down. The huge waves lashed across his body. He called for help, but his voice would not carry against the storm. Another pole struck him on the side of the head, knocking him unconscious. Then Sam appeared, Big Black Sam, and with superhuman strength removed the pole from my son's leg, lifted him in his great strong arms, and carried him to his bunk. Mr. Wells, did you ever feel very small and very humble? Perhaps not, but at that moment I felt smaller and humbler than I'd ever felt in my life or ever expect to feel again. Many things have happened since that day, but my eyes have kept opening wider and wider until, from now on, thank God, every vestige and prejudice has been wiped completely out of my heart. About 2 months ago, I came back down here to New Orleans on a visit. I don't intend to stay much longer. My friends say to me, you don't act like a true Southern woman anymore. True Southern woman, I exclaim. Maybe not, but at least I feel like a true American. Mr. Wells, what can I do? I feel so helpless, so useless in the face of all this. For now, more than anything else, I want to help give the colored people their freedom. Yes, I said freedom. I'm just one person, and a very insignificant one at that, but people will listen to you, so keep talking on this subject. Try to get it through their thick skulls that they're committing a sin against God and man. God bless you. Humbly yours, Mrs. Mimi Fawcett, 915 Royal Street, New Orleans, Louisiana. Mrs. Fawcett, you asked me if I ever felt very small and very humble. I do now, and I've your letter to thank for it. You say people will listen to me. If that's true, I pray God I'm worthy of their trust. I hope people, a lot of them, are listening today. I hope a lot of people heard your letter. You say you're just one person, a very insignificant person. Believe me, Mrs. Fawcett, you're just the contrary. You're a very significant person indeed. You're a white Southerner, and you've changed your mind. You've left behind you the black hatreds of white supremacy. You're not just one person. There are a lot of you. All the Bilbos notwithstanding, something new and good is happening down in the South. You want to help to give the colored people their freedom. Well, that's the grand and generous wish of every good citizen. But really, Mrs. Fawcett, I'd save your worries for the white people. Slavery does a very, very terrible thing to any people. But the ex-slave recovers sooner from the weakening shame of slavery than the ex-slave owner. You want so much to help, Mrs. Fawcett. Why don't you try helping the white people to gain their freedom as you gained yours? God bless you, Mrs. Fawcett. Now my time's up. Thanks very much for letting me come to call. Please join. Join us next week at the same time, same station. Till then, I remain as always, obediently yours.
Orson Welles is heard each week at the same time over many of these same ABC stations. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.